getting screwed, to be blatant about it. So that was what was the motivating factor, is people not having counsel. So in late 2018, the work group was formed. As background, the two chairs, there were two co-chairs. One of them was Justice Dino Jimenez. Many of you know Justice Jimenez, used to work at Jones Waldo. He's a very well-respected judge in our court system. He's also someone who really takes the bull by the horns, and that's, as we get into this, you'll see that that's what happened here. The other co-chair is John Lund, a Parsons, Bailey, and Latimer, and also a former bar president. So John and Justice Jimenez worked on a committee. They brought on a number of academics, people who had expertise in this area. And I urge you to take a look if you're interested in their task force report. I can't get into it with too much detail because it's quite lengthy. But if you look at this link at the bottom of this page, sandbox.utahcourts.gov or utcourts.gov, if you go to that, you can see the report. Narrowing the Gap is the name of the report that they came up with. Narrowing the Access to Justice Gap. So this report just came out in August of last year, hasn't even been out very long. And the good folks that put it together were influenced, I think, in large part by a number of academics who were interested in kind of disrupting the legal practice. And obviously the chairpersons were also interested in kind of seeing what we can do. And you'll see that they've done it in a way that's quite careful. They haven't, they're not just blowing the lid off of everything. They're going to study it. They're going to make sure that all of the new proposals are carefully vetted. But there's going to be some disruption, and that's what we're going to talk about today. So if you get a chance, go to this website, sandbox.utahcourts.gov, and you will see the report. You can also register to get updates on what they're doing. And you can also see who is going to be on, who was on the work group and who's on the new group that has been formed to kind of monitor this whole situation. Let's see. So the mission of the work group was to optimize the regulatory structure for legal services in the age of disruption in a way that fosters innovation and promotes other market forces. So to increase access to and affordability of legal services. So that was the goal. And that was frankly, what they got, came up with. I mean, they came up with something that is going to be disruptive. And if there's nothing else that I ask you to learn from our conversation today, your takeaway ought to be that this is going to be disruptive to your practice and everyone else's. So the main things that they recommended is that the Supreme Court, again, these changes to the rules of professional conduct come from the Supreme Court, not from the bar, not from the Bar Commission. Only the Supreme Court has the ability to make these changes, although they do put them out for comment. So the primary recommendations of the task force were to, one, loosen restrictions on the practice of law, lawyer advertising, solicitation fee arrangements, including referrals and fee sharing, which we'll talk about, and this is the innovative thing that other states are really looking at. They've suggested that the court set up a new regulatory body under the direction of the Supreme Court to advance and implement a risk-based, empirically grounded regulatory process for legal service entities. So the second one is what was kind of innovative, and that's other states that are looking at this have been worried about kind of causing problems or disruption that can't be undone. Once you let the genie out of the bottle, it's going to be hard to get it back in again. And so what the Utah group did, which is very exciting and interesting, and other states are paying attention to, is set up what's called the sandbox. And I'm going to talk about the sandbox a fair amount today, but the sandbox is really a new regulatory body that's intended to, if people want to come in with this new service that they want to provide, they want to they're going to look at it, they're going to approve it, and they're going to, and then they're going to monitor how it works for 2 years. So when we talk about disruption, let me just say that what they're talking about in essence is technological disruption. And what I mean by that is that what they're hoping, and this is important, what they're hoping is that technological companies will come in and come up with an app or a website or something that will help people solve these problems. For instance, if there's a landlord-tenant case that you get served with, maybe you could download an app and the app could walk you through what the case is about using artificial intelligence or something, and that people would then be able to put in their information, their name, their address, their other information, and that this app or this website would spit out an answer, and then would also calendar deadlines and other things. So if you talk to the members of the task force, they will talk about technological innovation. And disruption is going to come from technological innovation. The problem is most law firms are not developing this kind of technology. They're non-law firms that are doing that. If you think about LegalZoom, LegalZoom has been out for a number of years. They produce forms and other things. LegalZoom, I think, is one of the group corporations that's interested in jumping into this market and expanding their offerings to actually helping people draft pleadings and helping people draft motions. It sounds crazy to me, but that I think is one of the examples that I'm trying to help you understand what the potential is out there. Another potential would be there are already a number of forms on the, if any of you know any family law, you'll know that there's a system on the Utah court system that will let people fill out their own forms and get help through basically an automated system. And it'll take you, you know, from start to finish. And most family law practitioners that you talk to will say that it's not super great, but at the same time, it is out there, and they're saying, why couldn't we take this to the next level? Why can't we help people get more personalized advice? And that might mean that a technology company hires a bunch of lawyers to provide services to their customers, maybe on a salary basis or whatever. And that so the law firm would essentially be providing some personalized services, but also some technological services. I don't know. I want to be hesitant. I'm going to be hesitant to provide a lot of examples about what might happen technologically, because we don't know that yet. This hasn't started. But what the sandbox group is hoping is that there'll be a number of good companies who, like Google or Amazon or LegalZoom or who knows, maybe some new startup, who are going to propose this new technology that's going to solve some of these problems. And then the question is, okay, well, if we solve these problems through technology, that's great and all, but what other collateral impacts will this have on the practice of law? And I would submit to you that it could have other disruption or disruptive impacts that may or may not have ever been foreseen. I'm kind of getting ahead of myself. So the specific recommendations, these are the rules I'm going to be talking about. Ethics Rule 5.4 is going to be substantially modified. The new version of that has been sent to you this morning. If you didn't get a copy of that, ask Michelle to resend it, and you'll see that they've made two new sub-rules, basically Rule 5.4A and 5.4B, and we'll talk about those. And then the other recommendation that the task force made is to basically eliminate the rules on lawyer advertising and also a number of other lawyer communication rules. So I'll talk about that as well. And that didn't come in the package that was sent to you this morning because I don't actually have a copy of it. but I do have, oops, I will try to get that to you. I've been trying to verify whether the changes to Rule 7.2 are going to happen. Anyway, we'll talk about that, but you can think of how changes to lawyer advertising might change the billboards. It might change the online or TV ads that the various plaintiffs' firms are running. It also could change the dynamic of an interaction with a potential victim of a and one of the questions in my mind is, you know, are lawyers going to start showing up in the hospitals, you know, because now they can actually talk to people, I think, without really much restriction. And so how is that going to work? And the third thing that was recommended is to establish this new Standing Order 15, which was sent to you this morning. And you'll see that, again, that new standing order has some specific rules about how the Supreme Court is going to monitor this. So I'll get into those here. The sandbox is really an interesting innovation. This is supposed to be basically watching what happens and monitoring it. And they're not just going to let any old group, you know, start up a new proposed business that combines technology and the law, or combines some big corporation and a law firm. That's all going to have to kind of run through the sandbox. And that's, to me, that's a comforting thing. This is the thing that I like about this proposal, is that all of these things aren't going to just be, they're not just going to shut down Rule 5 or change 5.4 and then see what happens. Most of this needs to run, all the new business models need to run through the sandbox. And you can see this, I won't read this all, but they'll be monitoring them for 2 years. They've got some requirements about, you know, how's this helping? Is it, who's it helping? Who's using it, et cetera. And it's supposed to be approved under certain criteria. The criteria haven't been established yet. And if you look at, this is the question I always get, is like, well, what is the criteria that the sandbox people are going to, or the Office of Legal Services Innovation, what's the criteria for who they're going to approve? And the answer is, we don't know yet, because the criteria are somewhat set forth in Standing Rule 15, which, by the way, I just saw it for the first time 2 days ago. You're seeing it. You guys are some of the first people in the bar that are seeing this. It hasn't been circulated today to the bar as a whole yet, but it's going to be, I believe, coming out today, maybe while we're talking. Please feel free to circulate this as much as you want to whoever you can, because I want people to know about this. I'm happy to respond to questions and email and things. Anyway, the bottom, hopefully you can see the bottom bullet point on this, but the sandbox isn't even been formed, and yet they already have a number of companies that are already seeking approval and have put their applications in. So there are groups out there that have ideas that they want to do, that they want to get approved, and this is already happening. And hopefully this procedure and this office will carefully monitor what's happening. One of the questions I got from my firm is you know, whether if someone tries to buy our firm, I work at Ray Quinney, we're a Utah-only firm like many of yours, if someone wants to buy our firm, a hedge fund from New York, besides they want to buy our firm, is that going to be possible? And the answer is yes, potentially. Now, does that go through the sandbox? I believe it does, and I don't know if the sandbox is going to have, how they're going to deal with those kind of situations. And frankly, at the end of 2 years, if that doesn't work out, then what? That's one of my questions, but we don't really know the answer to that. So again, the objective of the sandbox, according to Standing Rule 15 that you have, is to ensure consumers have access to well-developed, high-quality, innovative, affordable, and competitive market for legal services. So they want to make the market for legal services more competitive. What is that? How does that impact your fee structures? Well, you can probably guess how that might impact your fee structure. I think it depends on the practice. But if you are now competing potentially against a company that has an app and has is basically using artificial intelligence to provide legal advice. How's that going to impact the fees that you can charge? How's that going to impact who you're going to hire? These are the kind of questions that I hope you'll be listening and thinking about. The next point, which is in Standing Order 15, is that the Supreme Court has taken the view that this new, innovative, affordable, and competitive market that we're all part of it is going to improve access to justice, which means it'll make it legal services more affordable, I believe. Now, some practices won't be affected by that, but many will. And then it talks about non-traditional legal services in there. You can see that quote, but it's not entirely clear to me what that means, but I think it means innovation. Innovative legal services, whatever that is, and we may all be shocked and surprised, or it may be that no one gets approved. We just don't know how that's going to go. So I want to talk now about the big changes into Rule 5.4. Right? And I apologize. Maybe I can look at the comments here. I don't know if I can.
Let's see, I've got three comments, or rather three questions, Mark, and we can just, if you want to keep presenting, we can just address the questions that are in the chat group at the end.
Okay, sorry, I'm not doing my PowerPoint very well. Let me try to read those if I can.
Yeah, if you go to the bottom of your screen, you should be able to hit chat. And it should tell you we've got one from the first one. Do you see them?
Are the ethical rules on the medical profession side, are there, I don't know the answer to that. There may be. It would certainly be something that those of you who are involved on medical malpractice cases should look at. I don't know whether that's ever even been looked at. There may be rules that prevent that, in which case, okay, that's good. But I hope that those of you who are inclined to comment, the comment period is going to be open tonight, starting tomorrow, on these new rules, that you will make the comments and look into this, because I don't do med mal work, and I hope that some of you who maybe represent doctors would be able to reach out to them. Again, the Bar Commission asked them to extend the comment period. I'll talk about this in a sec, but it's the comment period is usually fairly short. But in this case, we got them to approve 90 days to comment on this. So we have a little bit of time. And please, please, please encourage as many people from your firm to dig into this and give comments and provide those to the Supreme Court so that they can take that into account. From Todd, why do we believe the non-attorney entities will focus on areas of law where there is not much money rather than areas where there is money to be had? Okay, that's a really good question. And that's a question that I have too. I mean, I honestly think that companies out there who want to invest in the legal market, in my mind, they're not super interested in low income unless it's high volume. Maybe they can make money on that. I don't know. I hope that's the case. But it seems to me that the real attractive markets are gonna be law firms, and you know, if your law firm is purchased by a USAA insurance company, or if your law firm is purchased by some other group, you know, the question would be: Are fees going to go up or down? If my firm was purchased by KPMG, are they going to charge me out at a higher rate or a lower rate? I mean, I think I know the answer to that question, but it's going to be very interesting to see. And again, this is a big grand experiment, folks, and nobody's done this except for in England. They did it, but it was very, very different. And the task force points to the English model quite a bit in the report that if you look at it, but in my mind, it's apples and oranges in a lot of ways. I don't know that we know that those areas of law are going to be serviced by this. Because frankly, that's not where the money is. But you know, that's a very valid question. And if you so Shane, what is the remedy for a client against a provider that behaves unprofessionally or unethically? The answer is that lawyers are still going to be bound by the rules of ethical conduct. And you're going to see here that one of the things they've done in the rules, and I'll get to that, is they've made it very clear that these rule changes don't diminish the lawyer's duty of loyalty to a client. They don't diminish your duty of confidentiality, and that all of that stuff is still on there. So this is a very important question. It's like, if you have a boss who is a business guy, are his motivations or his incentives going to how are you going to keep them from his profit-centered motive from impinging on your duty of loyalty and duty of confidentiality to your client? Are you going to be able to take the same cases that you might otherwise take? I do a fair amount of pro bono work when I represent victims of fraud. If I have a boss who is, a more profit-centered, is he going to let me take those cases? Probably not. So does that help people? I don't know. And is there going to be recourse against the non-lawyers? No, I don't. The way this rule is set up is the recourse is against the lawyer, not against the company. But maybe the sandbox will have some sort of answer to that question. So those are some of the answers. I appreciate those questions because you guys are all focusing on some of the same questions that I have. And I hope that you will all focus on those questions and be able to ask those questions and address those to the Supreme Court in your comments on the rule change. All right, we're gonna get into a little bit of this. Let's see. So again, this is rule 5.4A sub A that you have. You can see that's not a red line that you got this morning, but it does show what the new rule will look like. And sub A of 5.4A says that 100% you still have these duties, these key duties. They don't go anywhere. Duty of independence of judgment, duty of loyalty to the client, duty of confidentiality. Now, again, if you have a boss, if you're an employee and or are sharing fees with someone and your boss is not a lawyer, do you have those same, is that simple? No, I don't think it's simple. If you've got some sort of situation that is challenging from an ethical point of view, we at my law firm, we have our general counsel, we have our ethics guru, we talk to them, we try to work through those conflict issues come up, as I'm sure in all of your firms, all the time. And we have to work through those. This rule would be allow us to make a new partner. And maybe that partner would be I'm going to throw this out. This is an example that I think about because I work in financial services. What if I had a partner who was an insurance salesman and another partner who was an equity partner in our firm who was not a lawyer but was rather a stockbroker or an investment advisor? How would that shape the advice that our folks in our tax planning group give? Are they going to give the same advice if they might be able to participate in some of the commissions from the products? I have spoken to the estate planning group at the state bar. I gave a presentation and they were really interested in this question, is why wouldn't they just form a one-stop shop for estate planning? And then how does that impact their duty of independence of judgment? Very interesting question. Another potential that you can think of on the plaintiff side, the tort side. What if Christensen and Jensen, Siegfried and Jensen, brought on a bunch of doctors, chiropractors, and other sort of medical professionals and made them partners so that they could be the one-stop shop for injuries for people? Come here, we'll give you free medical care. Oh, and by the way, while you're in here getting free medical care, we'll have you talk to the doctor, the lawyer down the hall about whether you might have a case. In my mind, that is potentially gonna happen under this new rule change. And how does that impact the lawyer's duty of independence, the duty of loyalty to the client, and the duty of confidentiality? How do those plaintiff's lawyers navigate the HIPAA issues and the confidential communications with the doctors who are now their equity partners? It's a fascinating situation. I don't know the answer to any of those questions. So, but that's the stuff I hope that you'll start thinking about. So again, here, I haven't given you all the details of this because you have the full rule and it gets kind of in the weeds, but the real stuff, the real changes are in 5.4A sub B through E. So the sub B is a lawyer or law firm may share legal fees with a non-lawyer if the lawyer or law firm provides conspicuous written notice to a prospective client of the relationship with the non-lawyer and the fact of the fee sharing. So you disclose it, and as long as you disclose it, you're good to go. And then this is in comment two under rule 5.4A. These paragraphs permit individuals, lawyers, or law firms to pay for client referrals. Oops, I can't see it. To share fees with non-lawyers or to allow third-party retention in a context that does not change the business model or structure of the lawyer or the firm's practice. So, really important. This is all going to be permitted. Now, this, I believe, and hopefully you can see that last power, that last bullet, which is down low on my screen, which is that this is still governed by Standing Order 15. So now, presumably, if Siegfried and Jensen, to use my same idea, if they decide to partner up with a bunch of chiropractors and medical professionals, you know, they would have to run this new plan, this new idea through the Supreme Court's group, and they would have to look at it and they would have to monitor it and see how it goes. But then, you know, one of the questions that keeps coming up is, what if it's not working out? How do you unwind that? Are there property rights that are being developed by those people? So that's something that, again, in your comments, you could certainly raise. So now, 5.4B. So this is, again, they've taken the old 5.4 and split it into two, 5.4A and 5.4B. 5.4B allows a lawyer to practice law in an organization that is managed or owned in whole or in part by non-lawyers, as long as you, again, give the reasonable disclosures. I'd be interested to know, I know there's folks, there's a State Farm, I believe, has a number of lawyers in this in Utah who are actually employees. They're not charging fees, so it's a little different. They're employees, but could that change? Could there actually be lawyers out there who are owned by a law firm that's owned by an insurance company and charged us an hourly fee, but then shared that with the insurance company? I think that would be a potential structure that would be acceptable under this new rule change. And then the question would be whether that gets approved by the Supreme Court's committee. I don't know. We don't know what's going to be approved and what's not going to be approved. And then query, how does that impact the services of legal, the services that are being provided to underprivileged people and underserved populations in the state? Does it improve it or not? That's the question. So I want to talk briefly about Ethics Rule 7.1. These changes are not in the materials that went out, but my understanding is that they are going to be part of the proposed rule changes that are coming out today. If not, they're going to come out pretty soon. But these are changes to the rules 7.1 through 7.6. And if you don't know what those are really the attorney advertising rules. And Ethics Rule 7.1 is modified to basically prohibit coercion, duress, or harassment when interacting with prospective clients. So this is, in my mind, intended to make sure that a lawyer isn't walking through the hospital or walking through other sort of environment where they're injured people and, you know, harassing them or coercing them into signing up a fee agreement. I think that's one of the main reasons Also cold calling and other sorts of things that could happen on the player side. And if I'm wrong on that, I'm open to correction. But that's very clear. Okay. So then what's changed? Well, what they're going to change is all the rules on lawyer advertising, gone. All the rules on solicitation of clients, gone. The rule on communication about your fields of practice, levels of expertise, gone. And even all the rules on firm names and letterhead will be gone. So the proposal, as I understand it, and again, for a reason that I don't, the material I got 2 days ago from Justice Simonis doesn't have these 7.2 through 7.5 are not in there, but I understand that's going to be coming out, if not today, in a short time. So that's how's that going to change things? Well, substantially, potentially. I mean, we can all think about what sort of advertising we're used to seeing on the billboards and on TV and in other environments. How will that change? How will it become more aggressive? Will it become more making lots of claims about recoveries that they've gotten? I suspect that we're going to see major changes in how plaintiffs, firms, especially the ones that advertise, are out there promoting themselves. So that could be interesting. I suppose if it gets out of control, the Supreme Court will, maybe they could, you know, ratchet back this one. This one to me is something that is more intended to just conform to modern rules of communication, the internet, social media, etc., to kind of free up lawyers from worrying about all those sorts of things. And it has not quite as much relevance to the overall goals that we're talking about. So these changes would not go through the sandbox, as I understand it. So anyway, I've got just a few more minutes. I want to kind of burn through this, that the rationale, according to the work group, is that it's meant to be open, flexible, and focused on the reality of the consumer experience with the law and legal services. That is the goal, is to open up the practice of law in a lot of different ways and to disrupt our practices. And I'm talking, we're all lawyers. This will be disruptive to your practice. It'll be disruptive to my practice. How will it be disruptive? Well, that's the question. And keep in mind, again, that the goal of this is to provide increased access to justice and legal services. That is the ostensible goal. And the hope is that the disruption will result in better access to justice. And, you know, that's, in my mind, the question is, will it actually do that? I don't know. We don't know. I don't think anyone knows. I mean, again, this is kind of a grand experiment. What's at stake? This is important. This, I believe, this is my personal opinion. This could represent the largest structural change for law firms and the practice of law in the history of the state. It's going to be watched by every other state in the country, the ABA. Everybody is paying attention to what Utah is doing. If it's a success, then you're going to see other bars follow, I suspect. If it's not, then, you know, well, who knows? We'll be on our own. Utah will be the first state to try it out. But again, other states are talking about this, looking at this. So it's been the subject of discussion amongst what we call barflies, you know, people who are really involved in kind of these issues have been talking about this for quite a while, and a lot of academics. So this is the question, is will it work? And this is the question that everyone keeps asking me. And I just want to read quickly a quote from this is the report from the Utah. There is a subcommittee, a court advisory committee, Supreme Court Advisory Committee on the Rules of Professional Conduct, chaired by Simon Kentrero. And he wrote this letter from his committee, and it says, you know, I just want to read this one paragraph to you, because it seems like even the committee that made these recommendations isn't really sure. And I think this is very frank of them to share this. It bears noting that the committee recognizes that the rules being amended have the potential to simultaneously benefit and harm lawyers economically and does not understand how, when, or to what degree. So even the advisory committee who is making these recommendations at the request of the Supreme Court has kind of said, yeah, you know, some people may get helped and some people may not, and we don't really know. And that's why I'm saying, this is why this is such a big deal. I hope people are getting that message, and I apologize for beating that horse. But the question again is, will technological innovation necessarily lead to increased access to justice? That is the question. And we don't know, and hopefully it will. So again, here's the website for the sandbox, utahcourts.gov. That has the report. It's a quite lengthy report from the task force on it. You can certainly look there. Again, the comments, according to the information I got yesterday from Justice Simonis, that the comment period will open either tonight or tomorrow. So you all are the first ones to have seen, you've actually got an advance look at the rule changes. They have not gotten out unless I haven't been monitoring my email, but maybe they've come out while we're talking. And the comment period is 90 days. This is something that every law firm should be paying attention to. And it may be that your law firm says, hey, we're gonna be on the front end. We're gonna come up with a new proposal, and we're gonna try to be on the benefit side of this. We're gonna try to be on the front end of technological innovation. Great. And your firm might also look at this and decide, wow, we need to really modify the way we do business, because otherwise we're gonna get crushed by this new stuff coming in. And so I think that's something that every firm needs to kind of look into and look at. And you can find me on my firm's website, but there's my email and that's my phone number, and I'm happy to get comments. But again, let me just be clear, I don't collect the comments. The comments are going to need to be submitted to the Supreme Court directly. And the email that comes out today, just like when you see other rule changes, we all get these emails on rule changes. I just am hoping that this one doesn't get put in your junk mail or your inbox or deleted, because this one is maybe more important. Let me submit that this is more important than many of the other rule changes that you're getting from time to time. A lot of those aren't that big of a deal. This one is. So please pay attention. Please share this with your law partners and help everyone understand how significant this is. And I see Michelle now. We've got is there a new comment?
Yeah, there's a new question from Sarah Vaughn that she asked. Do you see it there, Mark?
Yeah, I do. Are there any proposed changes to the rules of evidence to permit the discovery of new financial relationships that may be established? For example, if the treating physician is financially backing a lawsuit, would there be any way to discover that and present it as evidence? No. Answer is no. And that's something that is, you know, I think there's going to be a disclosure potentially. Those disclosures, I assume, would be discoverable. But there are no changes to the rules of evidence that I have seen that have been actually proposed. And so that's something, though, that as a defense lawyer, you would want to inquire into for sure. And I think, you know, this, again, this is a brave new world, and we don't know exactly how it's all going to play out. But I think you'd have a hard time saying that that isn't somehow relevant or admissible in some way. So any other law questions I'm happy to respond to. Now let's see them. So again, if people, I urge you, and Michelle, I'm going to see if this advisory committee letter that has a red line of these changes, if I can circulate this, I will, and you can send it to everyone. The changes are very extensive. The red line actually is a better way to look at it, because you can kind of see what's going and what's coming. But this is a big deal, and it could be have far-reaching impacts. Let me make one other quick comment, is if you there's a number of us on this committee, on the bar, that are on the Bar Commission. Again, we are trying to get the word out. Surprisingly, even the Judicial Commission hadn't heard about this until just a couple months ago in November, a few months ago in November. They are trying to get their arms around it too. We're all trying to figure out what's going to happen, how's this going to impact us, and we don't all know. So I think that's something that we're all trying to work through. And again, if you have thoughts about how the Bar Commission ought to be handling it, you can send those to me. But if you have comments on the rule changes specifically, don't send those to me. Please send those to the Supreme Court. Michelle, I can't hear you.
No, that sounds great. Looks like we have one more question on our chat from, oh, it's from Shane. Just says, thank you. It was very informative. Does anyone else have any questions before we let Mark go about the rule changes and everything?
I can't tell. If anyone's typing, that's great. I do think, guys, that your group is going to be impacted as much, if not more, than anyone. And so I also think the estate planning group is going to be really impacted by this. So I'm glad that you're doing this. If word gets out that, you know, people miss this and they want to do this again, Michelle, I'm happy to do it again. I've got the PowerPoint now put together with the new information. But again, it's big stuff and very, very interesting stuff. So I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to present.
Thanks so much for being here and helping us. And it's a 90-day comment period, correct?
Starting tomorrow, I believe, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, if we have more questions or if we feel like there would be a chance to have people, if we have people with more questions or whatever, we can reach out to you or maybe even do another one of these within the 90-day period. I think that would be very helpful.
That's great.
Thanks. And I'll send out anything that Mark sends to me. I'll pass on to this group as well as the rest of our members.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for the time.
Thanks so much, Mark. We appreciate it.
All right.